This meeting of the House Judiciary Committee will now come to order. The time is now 1:16 p.m. on Wednesday, April 1st, 2026. We are meeting in the Grunberg Room, Capitol Room 120. The following members are present: Representative Eichheit, Representative Costello, Representative Mina, and myself, Representative Gray, Chair. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. I would like to recognize the staff supporting this meeting: Sophia Tenney from House Records, Jude Augustine from the Juno LIO, and my committee aide, Dylan Hitchcock Lopez. We have three items of business scheduled for today. HJR 28, Support Kids Online Safety Act by Representative Eichheit, Representative HB 318, Social Media Minors by Representative Elam, and HB 64, Surrender of Infants, Infant Safety Devices by Representative Tomaszewski. Before we move into our scheduled business, I would like to bring back HB 242, Sexual Assault by Healthcare Workers, sponsored by Representative Hannon under bills previously heard. The amendment deadline for HB 242 was yesterday, Tuesday, March 31st, 2026 at 11:59 p.m. My office received no amendments. At this time, I would like to invite the sponsor, Representative Hannon, and her staff, Hunter Meacham, up to the front. I will note for the record that we were joined by Representative Vance at 1:17 p.m. Thank you for being here, Representative Hannon. Would you like to make any concluding comments?
No, but I wanted to thank the committee and thank you, Chair, for taking up the bill and by adjusting your agenda so that I could be here to thank you in person. As you know, this bill has a compelling narrative behind it, but I think it's an important policy change, and I am happy for your support and consideration to move it forward.
Thank you. I'll note for the record that we're joined by Representative Underwood at 1:17 p.m. Any questions or comments for the sponsor about House Bill 242? Seeing none, can we have a motion? It's on there. It says member.
Great. At this time, I move that House Bill 242, Work Order 34-LS1164-A, be reported out of the House Judiciary Committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
Hearing no objection, House Bill 242, Work Order 34-LS1164-A as an alpha is reported out of the House Judiciary Committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes. I authorize legislative legal to make any necessary technical and conforming changes.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to object and have a roll call vote.
Okay, thank you. Hearing an objection, would the clerk please call the roll?
Representative Eichheit.
At ease.
Mr. Chair, I removed my objection because I thought it was a different bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Hearing no objection, we will now go at ease to sign the paperwork. At ease. The record. For the record, I'd like to note that we were joined by Representative Kopp at 1:20 p.m. before we signed the paperwork. We will now move on to our first scheduled item on today's agenda, which is House Bill HJR 28, Support Kids Online Safety Act. At this time, I would like to invite the sponsor, Representative Eichheit, and his staff, Michael Busey, to the witness table. Please put yourself on the record and begin your testimony.
Good afternoon. My name is Representative Ted Eichheit. I represent House District 22, Northeast Anchorage, sometimes called North Modun. Happy to be here, and I'll let my staffer introduce himself.
For the record, Michael Busey, staff to Rep. Eichheit. Okay,
go ahead. So I'm here to introduce House Joint Resolution 28, encouraging Congress to pass the Kids Online Safety Act. So the question is, social media, is it safe for teens and children? Well, there's been a little bit of research done on that. We know that most teens use social media, and that can take a long time that they spend on the screens every day, 3.5 to 5 hours. We see this. We know this. We've researched it. We've also seen during the last decade that there's been increases in issues affecting minors on social media, including teen depression, eating disorders, bullying, sexual predation, and self-harm. So we know there is an issue, and these trends show a strong correlation with the expanded use of social media platforms.
I'll go back.
So that raises the question, why would online platforms allow harm to children? Very simply, the answer is money. Online platforms, their goal is to keep folks on them as long as possible and to collect data on them and target messaging, things like advertisements, so on and so forth to them. And we actually know this not we also all know this from the social media platforms themselves. In 2021, a Facebook whistleblower exposed internal documents showing Facebook knew its product was damaging to teens' mental health, but consistently chose to continue practices in the interest of profit over public health. And, you know, these types of strategies that keep folks online, and in this case, minors that we're talking about, are things like endless scrolling, autoplay, things that intermittent reinforcement, things that keep people online for long periods of time. And many of us have, as adults, have the same similar issues with these online platforms. We see it. So the media or big tech, they make their money by keeping people online for long periods of time. And that's a special concern when it comes to minors. We already know that kids scrolling through these platforms, using these platforms, have increased incidence of eating disorders. We know there's, as I said before, increased self-harm. It exposes kids to bullying and predators. And we've taken taken actions in this legislature to make sure kids aren't on their smartphones during the school day in class. We've made sure that we've made efforts to make sure that artificial intelligence isn't used to exploit children. Online big tech platforms are largely unregulated. It reminds me oftentimes of big tobacco. I'm a little older than most of the folks here on this committee, and I remember the saga about big tobacco. And you know, essentially, we knew that tobacco was highly addictive. Well, big tobacco did. They knew it caused harm, and that information was kept from the public. We have since changed that, and we have special laws and provisions that protect the young among us because we know those developing brains are especially vulnerable. So very simply, Senate Bill 1748, the Kids Online Safety Act, would require platforms exercise a duty of care in which they must prioritize children's safety and mental health. I'd like to read that again. It would require online platforms to exercise a duty of care in which they must prioritize children's safety and mental health. I think that's a very reasonable request. It would also require that minors' data be confidential. Senate Bill 1748 would prohibit collecting data on children under 13. And for children 13 to 16, it would allow parents to opt their children out of those algorithms. And no algorithms being used for minors under 13. So this is a reasonable bill that resolution, joint resolution, simply ask that Congress pass Senate Bill 1748 and the president sign it to start protecting kids now from the harms of big tech. Happy to take questions.
Are there any questions for the sponsor? Representative Costello.
I want to thank the sponsor for bringing this before us. My question has to do with the federal law act and what measures are in that act to hold companies accountable for the measures in the act.
For the record, Michael Busey, staff to Rep. Eichscheid, through the chair. Representative Costello, thank you for that question. Senate Bill 1748, Kids Online Safety Act, there is the ability for the FCC and state attorney generals to hold these platforms liable for damages and that they, without giving a specific punishment, it makes them culpable and liable for damages.
Permission to dialogue.
So is that, thank you, Mr. Chair. Is that something the states decide what the punishment will be, or is that something that's in the federal act? And then also when you would come by my office to talk about the bill, and I appreciate that, I wondered if other states were passing resolutions in support of this act.
Through the chair, Representative Costello, in answer to the last question, yes, last I looked, there were 17 states who've offered resolutions like this. And then as far as in the Senate bill, it does I can look it up. It doesn't give, like I said, it doesn't give a specific damage. It says to be determined that they could bring, a state could bring a case against these platforms, as California recently did against Facebook in determining damages and awarded a $6 million damage to the plaintiff for damages suffered from Facebook's algorithm and manipulation. And then in New Mexico recently also within this last month, I think it was a $350 million settlement for against one of the social media platforms, I want to say Telegram or Instagram, for allowing actually I'm not sure on that, but it was one of the social media platforms for allowing sexual predation to happen on their sites.
Thank you. I have a question. In your sponsor statement, you say that in 2022, this bill came up for a vote with 93 yay votes in the Senate, that it's been reintroduced with 75 Senate co-sponsors, including Senator Sullivan and Senator Murkowski. I'm curious about why it did not pass the U.S. House in 2022.
Thank you for that question, Chair. Chair Gray, the reason that it didn't pass the House, one aspect is the fact that Facebook, one argument is that Facebook worked very diligently on having its lobbyists assigned to dividing a bipartisan bill, really, and worked hard against it. I'll say that. Also, there was some contention about that there was enough safety for freedom of speech, that the original version of the bill didn't protect free speech well enough. And so this latest version of the bill that was reintroduced in the 119th Congress had a provision added in Section 102 that specifically prohibits the FCC or attorney generals from denying access for young people to have access to any content. So it addressed the freedom of speech issues. Yes.
Representative Mina.
Thank you, Chair Gray. Through the chair, I know that the Kids Online Safety Act has gone through different iterations since 2022, originally in the 17th Congress. And so specifically to the Senate Bill 1748, how has it changed and morphed beyond the provision related to the state AGs that you mentioned?
Through the chair, thank you for the question, Rep. Mina. What was added, what was changed, and permission to read?
Oh, you don't have to ask that here.
Okay. What was added, and if you don't mind, I'll read right from the act. It said, nothing shall be, the rules of construction, nothing in the subsection shall be construed to require a covered platform to prevent or preclude any minor from deliberately and independently searching for or specifically requesting content. So if a child wanted to look up something, they still can. It's not limiting that. Or accessing resources and information regarding the prevention or mitigation of the harms described in the subsection. Nothing in this section shall be construed to allow a government entity to enforce subsection A based upon the viewpoint of users expressed by or through any speech, expression, or information protected by the First Amendment to the Constitution of the United States. And so access, as I said, access to the internet is still uninhibited. Any content is available. What's not, what's being accomplished by the bill is taking out the design function that these social media groups have used, where a child looks up something about suicide and then the algorithm also collecting data on the child says, oh, suicide, you want to see suicide? Okay, well, then it'll take you to the next thing. And here, how about how to do suicide? And how about, hey, everybody, so that's the design, the duty of care that this law is trying to impose.
Follow up through the chair. Could you talk a bit more about how the current bill defines duty of care?
Through the chair, thank you for the question, Rep. Mina. And yes, the duty of care specifically addresses, and again, I'll read from the bill if you don't mind. It says a covered platform shall exercise reasonable care in the creation and implementation of any design feature to prevent and mitigate harms to minors where a reasonable and prudent person would agree that such harms were reasonably foreseeable by the covered platform and would agree that the design feature is a contributing factor to such harms. And then it goes on to list eating disorders, depressive disorders, anxiety disorders, patterns of use that indicate compulsive usage, sexual exploitation, all these things that, and again, in when Rep. Eichheit read about the whistleblower of Facebook. Facebook was well aware of the issues. And even there was a quote from their whistleblower that said they had determined that 30% of the teen girls that were using their site were being affected negatively and being pushed into depressive disorders. They're aware of it. They continued on because there was no federal law requiring them to mitigate the damage that they were causing.
Thank you.
Any other questions or comments from committee? Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for highlighting this issue. And I appreciate you coming by to talk to me about it. And I did read through the entire Senate bill in Congress and appreciate the work. I've been a part of a human trafficking forum with Senator Blackburn, who brought this forward, and she is known as being a champion against exploitation in DC. So I just want to give kudos to that. But I'm seeing a lot of consternation around constitutional issues with this particular bill, and what I'm seeing is that there's House members have taken elements of this bill and put it into the Kids Act, which is the Kids Internet and Digital Safety Act, this month, actually, to try to move some of those components. And was wondering if you've been tracking that And I guess my question is, what is your end goal with this? Because we've heard from our delegation that having resolutions, especially when they can get unanimous consent, is very, very helpful. But we want to stand in a position of strength that we aren't, that we're pushing an issue that we care deeply about, but that has, that's sound, right? We don't want to have doubt in people's minds. I would like to push the constitutional question about these companies. But I want to know where you stand in relation to pushing, you know, this particular bill or the similar bills that Congress is trying to work through those issues. Are you wanting to be nimble and us stand with them and show that we agree to what they're doing? Or is it all of the aspects in the Kids Online Safety Act that you want to stay true to that one?
Representative Vance, through the chair, thank you for the question. And that's an excellent question. The KIDS, K-I-D-S, mm-hmm. Act in the House has moved through the, I can't remember the committee, but Commerce Committee, I can't remember which committee, but it just passed out of committee mm-hmm. on a partisan vote of 28 to 26, I think it was. And one of the strongest criticisms that I've read in comparing it to the Senate version of the bill, which, well, it does contain a number of the provisions that the COSA or the Senate bill has, a couple of really important features that it doesn't have is it doesn't include the duty of care requirement, is my understanding and what I've read. And then also the second thing is that it is not as as strongly worded to allow states to enact stronger laws. And so the House version puts a ceiling on what states can do to regulate online platforms, whereas the Senate bill specifically states that if a state comes up with a more restrictive version, they're perfectly able to do that. So it's a states' rights thing at that point.
And if I may, Representative Ted Eichheit, for the record, Representative Vance, one of the things that really drew me to the Senate bill was the strong bipartisan nature, and that's important to me. I've had constituents ask me to be bipartisan, and so that version, Senate Bill 1748, was very attractive that way. And I feel the recent iteration has improved some of the concerns that the original iteration had. So, but the strong bipartisan nature of the Senate bill to me seemed very good.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think with this particular resolution, I think it might be, we have a decision to make on if we want to speak as one voice of the legislature to a principled issue that we want to take to the courts and challenge, right? And maybe we need to have some clarifying language in the resolution that says we understand there may be constitutional concerns. However, for the protection of our children and, you know, reining down that tech companies should have a responsibility. I think that might be something that I'm interested in rather than just having a, hey, do this one. We could say a little bit more that we recognize what's happening in Congress. However, let's push the envelope. That's my position on this and would love to hear, you know, where the committee stands on it. And this is obviously something that I think you're going to see bipartisan support on. But this one's interesting since it's taking on different versions in Congress. So I appreciate the research that you've done.
Any other questions or comments, Representative Mina?
Thank you, Chair Greer. Through the chair, I just want to clarify that with this version of CONA, that
The enforcement is through the Federal Trade Commission and state attorney generals. And I know a large conversation on this Senate bill is related to the interpretation of harm. And so I just want to make sure that harm would be up to our state attorney general. Is that correct?
Through the chair, thank you for the question, Rep. Mina. Michael Busey, staff to Rep. Eichheit. I'm looking in the bill. Off the top of my head, I know it seems to me that there is precedence. The enforcement is by the Federal Trade Commission. Shall enforce the title. And then it says nothing in this title should be construed to limit the authority of the commission, enforcement by state attorney generals. The state may bring a civil action on behalf of the residents to the state, on behalf of the state. So I don't know if that's answering your question.
I'll just follow up through the chair. It seems that since harm to minors, and I don't know the Senate bill as closely, but if it isn't defined currently in CONA, that it would be up to state attorney generals to interpret what that would mean. And I like a lot of the provisions in the bill. I think more privacy protections related to minors, prohibiting ads targeting minors. I think those are really good steps just to help regulate social media in a targeted way. My concern with this Senate bill is just how ambiguous harm is currently defined and how that may be interpreted differently depending on different states' attorney generals. Thank you for bringing this forward.
Oh, Representative Costello.
Well, I appreciate the members' questions. Is it possible to have the attorney general or somebody weigh in on what harm would be? It seems to me that after the harm has been experienced, that's when other states are able to come in and apply this law. It's unfortunate that I would like to see more safeguards prior to the harm, and I think that's the intent of the federal law. But if we could have somebody from Department of Law comment on that, that would be helpful, I think.
Thank you. We can get that. Before we go to public testimony, I just wanted to read from the Act, page 62, lines 20 to 23. Nothing in this Act shall be construed to prohibit a state from enacting a law, rule, or regulation that provides greater protection to minors than the protections provided by the provisions of this Act. So to me, that's super important that the bill is like explicitly stating, if states want to be stricter than us, please do. And I think that kind of helps inform the whole discussion about supporting this one specific act. It's probably not going to fix all of our problems, but it's explicitly allowing us to do more. Any other questions or comments before we open public testimony? Public testimony on HDR 28 is now open. Is there anyone in the room that would like to testify? Please come forward, place yourself on the record, and begin your testimony. Seeing no one, we'll go online. Trevor Storrs from Anchorage, if you could take yourself off mute, place yourself on the record, and begin your testimony.
Good morning, or afternoon, I should actually say. For the record, my name is Trevor Storrs, President and CEO of the Alaska Children's Trust. As the statewide lead organization for the prevention of child abuse and neglect, the Children's Trust is committed to making all environments Alaska's children interact in, including online, as safe as possible so that children can thrive. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in strong support for House Joint Resolution 28. The Kids Online Safety Act is proposed a federal legislation that would require social media platforms to implement privacy protections and limits on addictive design features such as infinite scrolling, push notifications, or autoplay streaming. Additionally, the Kids Online Safety Act puts responsibility for this issue where it belongs by shifting the burden from parents and families. The legislation would require social media companies to ensure their social media platforms are safe for kids. The legislation also creates transparency and parental tools requirements that would support dialogue between children and their families. Conversations between parent and child are among the most important protective factors in reducing harm to children. Because social media platforms operate nationally, federal legislation is essential. No single state can hold these companies fully accountable alone. In 2023, 72% of Alaskan high schoolers used Instagram, TikTok, and Snapchat several times a day, and 22% reported experiencing online bullying, and only 53% reported feeling like they mattered to their community. And according to Kids Count, 2 out of 5 Alaska high school students report feeling persistently sad or hopeless, a nearly 60% increase since 2009. Social media has been reported as a contributing factor to a decline in children's mental health by many Alaskan parents and children. And most concerning of all, Alaska's children are being targeted for extortion. Online platforms have made children vulnerable to predators who exploit their digital activity for extortion or abuse, a trauma that often goes unreported by kids. This resolution would put Alaska on record in support of federal action to protect our children and support families and navigate online safety. Again, on behalf of the Alaska Children's Trust, I urge your support for House Joint Resolution 28. Thank you for your opportunity to testify, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Storrs. Seeing no one else online or in the room to testify on HJR 28, testimony on HJR 28 is now closed. I would now like to set an amendment deadline on HJR 28 for Tuesday, April 7th, 2026 at 11:59 p.m. Please work with my committee aide to ensure that amendments are submitted on time. We'll now set HJR 28 aside and bring it back up at a later date. And we'll now take a brief at ease to transition presentations. Is to bring HB 318, Social Media Minors, up for its first hearing in our committee. I will turn it over to Representative Elam, the sponsor, and his staff, Kendra Broussard. Please put yourself on the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you. Bill Elam, representative for House District 8.
My name is Kendra, through the chair, my name is Kendra Broussard, staff to Representative Elam.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Gray, members of the committee, for hearing this bill. And I just wanted to give Representative Aishai a little shout out there, because this is all very important information here and work that we're trying to do. And so Kendra will be helping with the presentation here, but just a kind of a quick introductory statement. You know, I mean, you guys can read the actual written statements all on your own. You don't need me to necessarily do all of that, but I kind of wanted to just say that this is a very important issue, and social media, we've had a number of conversations about it. House Bill 318 really tries to give parents the tools to better manage their children's presence online. And then it also is a tool that also allows children in a variety of circumstances to also be protected at the same time. We were very careful in the drafting of this bill to make sure that it did not get any of the constitutional challenges that are out there. So it really is targeted and focused at technology, not at person's behaviors. So the goal and intent here is to manage the technology and to put the good rails and safety up for all of us, all of our children, to be able to have an online presence, right, where you can communicate freely. You can do whatever you want on the internet. But what it does is it attacks this microdosing of dopamine every time you move your thumb, every little video that you watch, as most of it was already fairly discussed in the last presentation there. It's a real issue. We are the product here, and it's addictive, it's aggressive. They know that it is doing this stuff. So what this bill attempts to do is give us some tools as parents where you can go in and set the settings. And I don't know if any of you guys have ever had an app on your phone or Microsoft tools on your laptop, and then you get the updates and then all the settings change, right? So that's the chasing around that parents have to do every time they make a setting. The tech company can change that back. This bill puts those rails up and says, "Nah, we're going to be in charge of how we manage this." So with that, I'll let Kendra go ahead.
Through the chair, Kendra Broussard. So I'll go to the first slide and social media and minors. So HB 318, the intent is to sets protections for minors by focusing on platform designs, data practices, and parental controls. So in the bill, there's default protections, design and notification limits, privacy and data safeguards, parental control, enforcement and accountability, and some narrow constitutional approach. So platforms today are designed to maximize engagement and not necessarily safety. So 95% of teens use social media with many online almost constantly. Nearly 1 in 5 teens say social media harms their mental health. And teens using social media 3+ hours a day face double the risk of anxiety and depression. And these are some stats that we got from the Pell Institute, our research. So, HB 318 puts safer defaults in place for minors before harms occur. So it requires platforms to provide, by default, a non-addictive content delivery system for known minors. It also prohibits the use of coercive or deceptive design features to discourage minors or parents from selecting or maintaining safer settings. Design and notification limits. So many platform features are designed to increase usage, not protect minors. So 1 in 3 teens use screens until midnight or later and impacting sleep. Features like infinity scroll, autoplay, and push alerts drive repeated use. These patterns are linked to poor sleep, reduced attention, anxiety, and depression. So in this bill, there's no notifications during school hours and 10 p.m. throughout 7 a.m. There's exceptions for safety and emergencies, and there's also an opt-out option for parents or guardians. Minors' data is widely collected and used to drive engagement, and this is another issue. So nearly all teens use platforms that collect personal data. It targets advertising and tracking shape with what minors see and do. So many teens report concerns about privacy and how their data is used. HB 318 strengthens protections for minors by prohibiting targeted advertising to minors, limits data collection to what is reasonably necessary, it bans precise location tracking, and requires accounts to be private by default. So also through this bill, there's parental control. So most parents say managing social media is difficult and constantly changing. Platforms often lack clear defaults or meaningful parental tools. Current systems place the burden on families instead of platforms. So through this bill, it requires verifiable parental consent for added features. It keeps safe settings as a default and ensures parents, not platforms, decide a child's experience. Enforcement and accountability. So HB 318 is enforced through Alaska's existing consumer protection framework. So through the bill, it is enforced by the Attorney General under existing consumer protection law, authorizes regulation for age assurance, parental consent, and design features. It requires annual reporting from platforms on design, data, and mitigation efforts, and it protects trade secrets while establishing clear definitions and scopes. So there are several states that are actively addressing social media harms, but courts are shaping what works. Several states, Arkansas, Utah, and others, have passed laws restricting access or requiring age verification. Many of these laws are being blocked on First Amendment and privacy grounds, and then the challenges focus on laws that limit speech access or are overly broad. So this is, there's a couple of different approaches that are emerging. So New Mexico, Meta was just held liable under a consumer protection law for harms to minors. And then through the Senate Bill 1748, the Kids Online Safety Act, it would establish a duty of care for platforms. HB 318 follows this legally durable path. So it targets platform designs, notifications, and data practices, not speech. It preserves access to social media and user expression. that uses existing consumer protection enforcement and provides default protections with parental choice. On this slide, I probably am not going to go through this slide in detail, but if just had some different research facts from the Pew Research Center that were very interesting. And are there any questions?
Thank you. Are there any questions from committee? Representative Kopp.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Sarge, for rolling that bill. So the thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll speak into the microphone. So the definition of kind of reasonably necessary. So it's limiting the platform to collecting data that's reasonably necessary. So just thinking about it, maybe how we could refine that a little bit further, because I think what the bill sponsor is saying is we don't want the advertising, the profiling, or engagement modification type stuff going on with the kids. And I was thinking maybe we could flesh that a little up. Maybe it's just a definition to clarify what we mean by what's reasonable, and including, you know, prevention of fraud and maybe some other things. And maybe there's some good model definitions, but I was thinking if maybe we could talk about that for a minute.
We could do that. Yes. What page are you on there? Give me just one moment here, please.
And I forget exactly which section of the bill. When Ms. Broussard read it, that kind of piqued my – but I forget exactly where that's at. I was looking for it again. Oh, yeah. It's on – actually, it's on line 3 of page 3, where it says a social media platform may not, for a known minor, going to line 3, collect or retain the minor's data beyond the extent reasonably necessary to provide the social media platform to the minor. So, you know, like what is, you know, just refining that definition a little more. So we're really clear. We don't want you profiling our kids. We don't want you maybe advertising or doing engagement modification where you're using the algorithm of feedback to selectively pull them towards a certain,
right,
you know.
And so I'm definitely open to conversation about the, some of those, you know, better definitions maybe. Conceptually, some of the issues that I've had has been with addictive, the amount of content tracking that they do within these platforms is just extreme. And so we do want to kind of have maybe the Attorney General involved with coming up with some additional regulation for how we're going to maybe enforce some of these things, but then also I don't know if I'm going down. I don't know if I understand really what you're maybe the question a little bit.
Oh, that's fine.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, it's almost feels like Friday afternoon.
It does.
So, yeah, you know, just reading the plain language about what the social media platform may not do, and going back to lines 2 and 3 on page 3, it says they may not collect or retain the minor's personal data beyond the extent reasonably necessary to provide the social media platform to the minor. So reasonably necessary is very open.
Yeah.
The definition. So I was thinking if there's not even a problem with that sentence per se, it would just be a definition of what we mean by that. And we say, you know, here's what we mean. So we can address both what we think the user who is controlling this wants.
Right.
And also what we're pretty sure we're all trying to stop here, which is the almost –
right,
you know, unconscious advertising and profiling and engagement behavior modification of the child online.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I see what you're saying now. We could definitely work on some better definition around some of that. The challenge that we were, you know, kind of running into is what amount of data is necessary, and so the platforms. So I mean, we could definitely come up with some more specific details of what we don't want them holding on to, because there is a lot of data there, locations, times of use. There's a lot of stuff there. So whenever I was drafting some of this and working with legal, we had you know, kind of some of the concerns of, you know, how do we get some of this implemented? And so the tech companies are definitely going to push back on us on a few of these items of what they need for the data. But I think we could actually come up with some very narrow, thou shalt not keep some of this data.
Right.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Mina.
Thank you, Chair Gray. Through the chair, there's a lot that I do appreciate about the bill, particularly your approach to look at the design of these websites and the algorithms rather than their particular content, and comparing other states that have been implementing these types of laws now and seeing the challenges that they've been facing. So I really appreciate your experience in this field. I have a question. I think I'll start out with how this parental verification aspect. I know that this committee, I haven't sat at this committee in the previous legislature, but I know that previously this committee has discussed age verification software in social media very often. And, you know, there are some privacy concerns there. I know that this isn't age verification explicitly, but looking at page 2, line 20, the minor, it has to be a known, well, first of all, on line 17, it has to be a known minor. And then line 20, that known minor has to obtain parental consent. So my first question is, how do you know if a user is a known minor? And then second, how do they obtain parental consent with respect to the same privacy concerns that are highlighted in the bill?
So absolutely, you're correct. Doing the age verification is a challenge here, and it has been an issue in a variety of states. We went with known minor. There's a lot of information available to the state to be able to validate ages. And so PFD, for example, we know how old a lot of folks are in that process. And so there's a lot of data here. Farther on in the bill, the Attorney General is actually tasked with finding a solution for that.
Follow up?
Yes.
Through the chair, I was reminded that it is defined in the bill, the known minor aspect, on page 4, lines 10 through 12. So it's a user of a social media platform that the social media platform knows or reasonably should know. And so, you know, what I do like about the bill also is the accountability on the companies, because it's really the companies that are crafting these algorithms that are very addictive. How do we make it into this situation where a social media company just says, oh, we didn't know that that was a minor, sorry, and they avoid culpability?
I mean, that's a great question. You know, I guess, you know, when we talk about companies dodging out, they're going to do that. You know, I don't know that I have necessarily a good answer for, you know, how do we as a state keep companies from lying to us? Like, that's going to be a risk. The intent is to be able to put some rules here in place to get some, to get the needle moving in the right direction so that we are able to provide protections for the individuals that we do know. Age verification, I mean, anywhere you've got VPNs and different technologies, people are trying to dodge out of all of this. So I would say that, you know, from my perspective, we would take a stance on it. And then we may have to work on that a little bit more, as companies are dodging it, you know? So, I don't know if that's a good answer for you, but you know, that'll age verification is a challenge.
Sure. One last follow-up on just on this part. Thank you through the chair. And I appreciate you recognizing the difficulty of the verification aspect, because I think so much of the efficacy of the bill depends on whether you can ascertain who is a minor or not. And it is difficult, especially in regards to our privacy laws. Just finally, on the parental consent, I know there has been different ways of trying to do this type of identity verification in other law in other states, and primarily it is through age verification. I've heard less about the parental consent aspect, so I was wondering if you all had examples of what parental consent looks like for a minor trying to get on YouTube.
There's not a lot of really good examples out there. And so this is we're starting that conversation. You know, the websites that are out there that are of an adult nature have requirements for age verification, you know, and the realities are is that it's pretty hard to actually enforce specifically the age verification. People can lie. And so yes.
I was just going to say that Representative Vance and I have had, as members of the previous committee, have had many, many conversations about this and on the record. But something that's changed a lot since those initial conversations that we had is that AI is able to predict ages very accurately.
Yeah.
And it knows when children are interacting with it in a way that even 2 years ago we couldn't have said that way. So I think fleshing out, you know, how AI is able to verify ages and how it does it just by the way the child is, the language it's using, the spelling it's using, the way it's interacting with the platform itself. I mean, I think there's ways to do age verification now that we didn't really have even last year. And so, yeah. I don't know, it's hard.
Right. And I guess that's kind of what I was struggling with from an answer perspective is the onus is really on a lot of the tech companies for doing some of this. And so can we put in laws, you know, that we would do a variety of things? Sure. But the technology is actually there. They know when a child is using these systems. There is no mystery to it most of the time. The question is like you were saying, are they dodging it? And there is a lot of national effort right now to hold these companies accountable to be able to do this.
Thank you. And thank you for bringing the bill forward. I'm going to make a comment that I probably shouldn't, but I'll say it. When we have worked on this issue in the past, the constitutional issue has come up many times, and I've crafted a bill to try to avoid some of those constitutional issues that we see in other states. What I will say is that if our constitution is preventing us from protecting our children, then we need to change our constitution. We need to amend the constitution so that it is not courts that are deciding what we can and can't do to protect our children. And, you know, we haven't amended our U.S. constitution in my entire lifetime, basically, and that's too long. And I think this would be an issue that we might be able to raise to that level. But that's off topic. Representative Kopp.
Yeah, good discussion. And I want to commend the bill sponsor and his staff on this issue. So, you know, Representative Mina brought up a good question, you know, about the known minor. And I think that, you know, right now, most of the age verification stuff, you know, that we see on social media is self-identified, mm-hmm. right? It's self-identified. So it seems like part of the definition would be a person who has self-identified as under 18. That's certainly part of it. They've already indicated that, yes, they're under 18. And then, you know, we just require them to, you know, use best industry standards on reasonable age assurance identification measures. Because the industry standards are evolving too. Mm-hmm. So you're right. It's impossible to craft it exactly because the technology is evolving so fast. And as Representative Gray, Chair Gray points out, the ability now to accurately track that just through Q&A with the user, they can dial it in pretty
well. And it's been an international Wild West. There is no rules out there for most of this stuff.
Yeah. One other comment, just from the social media platform, not that we're all on that, protecting that bandwagon, but just I'm trying to think it's, you know, for those people that are trying to comply, maybe we need to look at something like a safe harbor for them where they just, if they can demonstrate good faith compliance. In other words, they may have missed something. They may not have automatically reverted to the basic accessibility features when the parent maybe turned off, you know, higher account features. And, you know, social media platforms can revert all the way back to entry level stuff. And there may be some, but I think maybe something that says a platform is not liable if they demonstrated good faith compliance efforts, because still it's the onus on them. And I think the goal is to catch the bad actors. And I'm thinking some of our smaller businesses with small social media followings, you know, but maybe we have businesses with just, you know, thousands of people following them. And in fact, I think we had another bill where we actually set the limit, right? You had to have so many users online before it applied. Because we're looking at the large scale social mm-hmm. media users, not necessarily a yeah. successful private business that is marketing donuts.
Yeah. You know, and I would also say that it's also the state of Alaska saying, you know what? There is a lot of conversation going on. We have a lot of parents that are concerned. We have a lot of individuals across our state that are being affected by this. Mm-hmm. And we are a part of the conversation that's happening here. And so I think as a state, we would benefit greatly by being a part of that conversation. I also do have some invited testimony as well.
I was going to say, do you want to go to that? We'll go to our first invited testifier, maybe our only invited testifier, Ryan Tunseth from Kenai. If you could take yourself off mute and begin your testimony. Oh, okay.
Hi. Good afternoon, Chair Gray, Vice Chair Kopp, and members of the House Judiciary Committee. For the record, my name is Ryan Tunseth. I'm a longtime Kenai resident, a father of three boys. I'm the president of the Kenai Peninsula Borough Assembly, and I'm also the president of the board of directors for the Boys and Girls Clubs of the Kenai Peninsula. I'm speaking here today as a father and an advocate for Alaska's youth through the Boys and Girls Club. We support House Bill 318. I'll keep my comments focused on what I think matters for this committee. What I like about this bill is that it's going after how these platforms are built and not what people are saying on them. It's not trying to regulate speech or content. It's looking at things like infinite scroll, autoplay, and constant notifications, features that are designed to keep kids hooked as long as possible. I think that's the right place to focus, especially if we want something that will hold its ground in the courts. The other thing that I appreciate is that it's very measured. It's focused on minors. It gives parents more control instead of taking it away. And it avoids opening the door to a wave of lawsuits by keeping interpretation and enforcement with the Attorney General. From my standpoint, both in public service and working with kids through the clubs, I can tell you that this isn't theoretical. We're seeing these effects: sleep issues, anxiety, short attention spans, depression, withdrawal. And it's not just hard on the kids. Myself as a parent and other parents, we're struggling too. Managing time, access and exposure to these platforms has become incredibly difficult. And when you dig into the research, it lines up with what we're seeing firsthand. In the book, The Anxious Generation by Jonathan Haidt, it outlines a clear connection between modern social media design, rising anxiety and depression in teenagers, especially tied to algorithm-driven feeds and constant feedback loops. Another book, Glow Kids, by Nicholas Carderis, he makes a similar point that this isn't just about content, it's about systems built to hold attention and how that impacts developing brains. To put it plainly, these companies are expertly writing addiction code, and they know it. That's why this bill matters. It's targeting a real specific harm tied to design and not speech. We absolutely need to step into the space, and we need to do it in a way that's targeted, reasonable, and has a real chance of holding up. Make no mistake about it. These are multi-billion dollar businesses built on capturing and selling our kids' attention. They are the product, and they will continue to do everything they can to keep that influence. I think this bill is a great step forward in putting some guardrails around that, and I would really urge your support. Thank you again for your time today and the opportunity to testify in support of House Bill 318.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Tunseth. Is Dr. Keith Hamilton online?
Yes, I am.
Thank you. If you could take go ahead and put yourself on the record and begin your testimony.
Great. My name is Dr. Keith Hamilton, and I am the president of Alaska Christian College, also on the Kenai Peninsula. My background and my doctorate is in youth and family culture. And, of course, the things that we're speaking about today have to wrap themselves all around youth and family culture. As somebody who's worked with teens for the last 40 years, and now especially young college-age students, I can attest to some of the sociological issues that we're seeing on our campus, but also in just the whole realm of children that we serve and work with as well. And just want to mention a few of those to you today, which you're very familiar with. But addiction and loss of control, these social platforms are really designed to help us keep engaged. And I see our students and others with endless scrolling, of course, hitting the notifications or likes because they want to trigger that dopamine effect. And we know this can lead to compulsive checking. And I think some of us adults are probably guilty of that as well. Strong difficulty in focusing, especially educationally, when the phones are allowed in the classroom or in different kind of educational venues. And then many, many wasted hours without even realizing that you've been on your device. And sociological also contributes to poor sleep and those late night scrolling delays. Sleep, those blue light disrupts our natural sleep cycles. We've seen and heard that in many studies, case studies. Of course, the results end up in students having great fatigue when they show up at school in the morning. Their mood is lowered, and then they also have reduced productivity when they're in the classroom. I think the biggest thing that we notice on the college level, which can, you know, brains aren't completely formed each other, 25 we hear, is especially in early adulthood, they are really involved in pressure to be constantly exposed to others' success and their appearance and their lifestyle, which causes insecurity and confusion about their personal direction and kind of always feeling behind. And during COVID, especially, we noticed the real strong reduction in real life relationships that were going on because we didn't have the face-to-face interaction as much as we did. Many of us were wearing masks. Shell communication now is being replaced, unfortunately, with the deeper connections that we need as humans today. And so our social skills are weaker. Our isolation is stronger. When we returned back from COVID at the college, we were all separated out and had students that were isolated for almost the entire year. And it really caused a huge loss in the number of students we were able to educate and also how we educated them. The short attention span, of course, you know, the reels, the shorts, the TikToks, the brain is being trained now to expect constant stimulation. It makes it so much harder to focus on their reading and their studying and some of the deep thinking that needs to happen. Just to kind of finish it up for us here, these habits that they're doing now, they tend to stick. And we know this because patterns that we build in our early years, especially technology, follow us for decades, that attention span, that time management, and emotional coping habits. So the bottom line is this, and I'm sure I'm preaching to the choir here, but social media becomes harmful, but it replaces real relationships. But it drives comparison instead of contentment. But it consumes time instead of adding value, things we could do instead, and shapes identity more than truth and real life experience. So as I've read through HB 318, and I don't know the technology pieces of it, others much smarter than me do, I know that the sociological effects on our children today is difficult, it's rampant, and this is just one start, I think, but our nation is starting to see the results. And this is Alaska's first step forward into this realm, and I encourage it both as a dad and as a college president and somebody who's worked with youth the last 40 years of my life. So thank you for considering HB 318, as we in the Kenai are super passionate about.
Thank you, Dr. Hamilton. Are there any questions for either Mr. Tunseth or Dr. Hamilton? Representative Costello.
Thank you. My question has to do with the statistics related to adolescent depression, and do we have statistics in Alaska? I mean, I'm aware of the behavioral risk survey and those types of things, but do we have some data that points to rates of depression?
This is Ryan Tunza. Thank you for that question. I know that I don't have them readily available right now, but I know that we do have some of that statistical data that's available to us through Boys and Girls Club of America, and I would be happy to follow up and provide that.
Thank you, Mr. Tunseth. Representative Aishai.
Representative Kuz.
Thank you, Chair Gray. This is a question that's optional for either invited testifier because I'm asking for what I consider private information. I am not a parent, but I've been a teacher. I retired from that work in 2015, and obviously social media was common then. The question I have for either invited testifier is, if they are a parent or if they work with children, do you feel that adults have lost the ability to protect their children from social media or to manage their use? And I say that from the context. I ask that question from context because I've heard a lot of my former students who are adults, well in adulthood, and they have children, and there's this big argument, the kids want a smartphone. And some parents don't want to do that, but there's a huge pressure. And I'm just wondering, are modern day parents, do they feel they've lost the ability to manage their children's lives as it comes to social media? Because I heard the word addiction codes. Addiction codes. So if any invited testifier.
Dr. Hamilton or Mr. Tunseth?
I'll go first again. Thank you for the question. This is Ryan Tunseth again. You know, I would just preface my answer by saying, you know, my oldest is 22 years old, and he's just about to graduate college here in a month. My second oldest, Mason, is he's a junior in high school, and he's 17, and my youngest, Henry, is 14. And, you know, I would say to answer that, like, absolutely. I was slow, you know, to understand it myself. And by the time that I really kind of fully understood what was going on, they were digital natives in this world. And it was really so far beyond both my wife and I's understanding of how far they, you know, had developed some of the habits they had. But also like how many different platforms that there were. And so it just was almost like speeding out of control. And so trying to kind of claw that back has been, you know, extremely difficult. And I sort of view myself as somebody who's like, you know, we're sort of lost. We lost, but maybe other kids and other parents would have a chance by starting younger. But at this point, trying to like get my own kids to completely be off of it is like a daunting task. And really you just have to try to manage with, you know, the best you can, time management. But to answer your question, you know, directly, I would say yes. I think that myself, people in those same cohorts would absolutely feel like, to a certain extent, they've lost a little bit of this battle.
Dr. Hamilton here. I concur with Mr. Tunseth. I'd say that every parent, from the day a child is born until they're maybe out of the house at 18 or beyond, the number one thing they're looking for is safety, and parents provide the number one thing is safety. And when there's no barriers and when there's no gutters on the side of the bowling alley, we can really get all over the map. And we have allowed our children to go way beyond, I think, what we would consider safe places, and it has caught us in the pants. We are a nation today of young people who are digital natives. I am not. I'm a secondary, you know, coming in the door here. But these students and children, they are living 24/7 with the thought of their next opportunity to get online to make sure they're connecting with this person or that media, that game. I find a lot of our students engaged in gaming that is also doing a lot of the similar things and taking them away from success. So, yeah, as parents, I think the horse is out of the barn, and that we have put a guardrail to other parts of our children's lives, but for some reason, we missed the opportunity to really do that. I know many parents now saying you get a dumb phone until you're 16 when they have more responsibility and capacity to not look at things on their phone I'll just add this one fearful comment, but I'm going to say it, that pornography is so accessible via these phones that our children are accessed to things that we would never, ever think of having accessibility to. And we have to put guardrails around that piece, especially as a family, as a nation.
Thank you. Any other questions from committee for invited testimony? Seeing no other questions for our testifiers, are there any additional questions for the sponsor or staff before we set HB 318 aside? Representative Mina.
Thank you, Chair. Great. Through the chair, I wanted to look at the definition for social media on page 4. And so subsection 3A on line 14, you talk about it's a website, application, or a digital service. And then subpoint B excludes an online service, website, or application, which the exclusive function is electronic mail or direct messaging. So I'm trying to figure out how to reconcile that. So is the definition of social media websites that we currently think of as social media, like Facebook, Snapchat, TikTok, because all of those also have direct messaging capabilities. And so I'm trying to figure out, how do you include both of those parameters?
Through the chair, it's a great question. And it was actually something that we really focused on more from the perspective of Teams, Zoom, communications platforms specifically. And so if it's an email platform, like say your Outlook.com or Yahoo or any of those direct, just specifically communications platforms. You'll also find in here that we are not really focused on the direct messaging component of it, and it's intentional because of the First Amendment components of litigation risks.
A follow-up? Through the chair, so if I have Facebook on my phone and I want to message someone, I have to download another app for Messenger. That is a social media platform where Facebook is the platform, but then the Messenger app is also the exclusive function of direct messaging between private users. So what I want to prevent is a loophole for a social media company. And I do appreciate the intent of excluding Teams and Zoom, since people use that in school. So that's just my concern with the definition.
Through the chair. So the platform for the social media app and the Messenger app, using Facebook as an example, they're the same source behind it. That's the user interface that you're looking at. So behind it is the same thing. So how you engage with it and the direct messaging component of it, it wouldn't exempt it. That wouldn't be a loophole. I mean, I'm not a high paid attorney, but that wouldn't be a loophole in my mind from a technology perspective.
And I would just say page 4, line 19, exclusive function. So,
yes.
I mean, Facebook Messenger's exclusive function is – I mean, Facebook, it's not – its exclusive function is not to be an instant messenger. It's to be Facebook.
Yes.
And I just a quick comment. I mean, I do know that there are a lot of individuals who they don't like social media, but they do use Messenger to communicate with folks, similar to how people use WhatsApp to communicate with family. I know that's pretty common, especially in, you know, areas where you might not have a phone, but you want to communicate with your family overseas. So I just want to put that out there, that some people do just use social media only to communicate with other people and not specifically for the rest of the application.
If I may. You're absolutely correct, but they are still in a social media platform, even they're only using 1% of it, you know, and it's the messaging component, but this would still apply to the whole. So there wouldn't really be a loophole there.
And it's my understanding, if the sponsor can correct me if I'm wrong, if minors were only using the instant media, the instant messenger aspect, I mean, none of this bill applies to instant messaging.
Correct.
So we could just absolutely slam this bill into law and let them instant message all day long.
Correct.
And no changes.
No changes.
Yeah.
Yeah. But the addictive algorithm and the doom scrolling, that would be addressed. Yeah.
Any other questions? Representative Eichheit.
Thank you, Chair Gray. Just a comment. I appreciate this bill. I think there's some good dialogue here. There's always nuance. You know, I think the intent, as I read it, is it's the addiction codes, the features that hook folks onto this. And, you know, it's interesting how we protect kids from other addictive products. We take tangible actions. And this has been something that has snuck up on us. And, you know, my experience with addictions is addictions sneak up on you. It's not like you wake up one day and it's like an on-off switch. So I appreciate the bill and the bill sponsor intent with this.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Thank you. I'm going to do something unusual. So we have a member of the public who would like to testify. We did not notice public testimony, so I will notice public testimony in the future. I will allow the member of the public to testify now about the bill. Sorry, Eddies. Back on the record. I'm sorry, we have additional invited testimony. We'll call Linda Sharp forward to testify on the bill.
Thank you for allowing me. I've met a few of you this week in person, and one that I wanted to but wasn't able to yet, actually two. I appreciate you allowing me to speak. My name is Linda Sharp. I've lived in Alaska since 1971. Came up here when I had a year of college left, and I finished at UAA, and I now have 3 degrees at UAA, all in education. I was the principal of a K-8 school in Anchorage. Public school. By the way, all charter schools are public schools and cannot charge tuition, just for the record. Much prior to when I even had kids, which started in 1987, I was interested in neurology, and I was noticing that a lot of my friends who had kids were using TV as part of how they were raising their kids and how early childhood programs were filling the time. And I thought that that was unusual from my knowledge. I hadn't yet worked in education at that time. I graduated in 72 and worked in private industry. And then when I had children, I thought, I don't want them just sitting in front of a TV for babysitting. No matter how nice the babysitters were, I didn't want that. And so I decided to stay home. I started an early childhood program, licensed, in my home for 4 years. Both of my kids were born by then. And that continued until the little one went to a full-day program, a kindergarten program. Shortly after that, actually 30 years ago, I was here lobbying, and I got the charter school bill passed. And I actually founded a charter school, kindergarten to eighth grade. We had no computers, which was a big controversy for the school district, along with some other things. And by the way, I'm not here on behalf of any religion at all. Through the years, I stayed in touch with many of the kids who completed through eighth grade and through their families as well. And even now, I would say maybe 10 or 20 of them a year call me up or ask to visit with me, or I bump into them in the grocery store or their parents and comment on the fact how they appreciated the school and the values that they got. And the lack of computers was a controversy for some people not to enroll in our school because we said we weren't going to have computers available. The school started, by the way, officially, I think, in 1998. And I retired in 2007. I will say that now I see children at age 2 or 3 with iPads, and they're used as a babysitter because parents' lives are such that they can't afford full-time babysitters, or maybe they don't want full-time babysitters. Maybe they don't need them, but they do need it spontaneously. Maybe driving around town in their cars or going out to visit relatives or trips or whatever, it keeps the kids from crying. And so even in the car, many of these kids learn from the age of 1 or 2 how to flip to page, I mean, if you watch kids that have a device in their hand, whether it's their parent's phone or an iPad, they can flip just like this by the time they're 1 or 2 years old, and they know what they want. And neurologically, I'm no expert in neurology. I don't have any degrees in it. But I can tell you that's not good for a kid to have their eyes trained onto a device as many hours as many kids are. Somebody asked about percentages or surveys. I don't have that either. But I can tell you it's not a small percentage that this information applies to. It is not unusual right now. Again, no expertise. I'm not in the schools. But I talk to principals. I talk to teachers. I talk to parents. And I talk to my former students who are now mostly in their 20s and 30s. I don't think any are in their 40s yet. But many or most kids in elementary schools now bring cell phones with them to school, paid for by their parents. And the most common complaint of parents is, we have no control. Our kids are fighting us. You know, we find them watching their cell phones until midnight, and then we have a hard time getting them out of school, and then they're or up for school. Sorry about that. I'm a little bit nervous because I didn't plan to speak today. I just wanted to hear what was being said.
And we'll need just 30 more seconds.
Okay, no problem. So I would just say that I think that you can't go wrong with a bill like this. I haven't studied it, so I don't have any particular details, but it can be corrected. If you overextended the rights of the parents by limiting what kids can watch, I think the law could be changed and retracted a little bit. So I would just say move ahead if you can. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Sharp. We'll now move to Jeff Delifke and Kenai. If you could take yourself off mute and begin your testimony.
Thank you. Yeah, my name is Jeff Delifke. I'm a local attorney on the Kenai Peninsula and an active youth advocate. I want to speak to just the broader concerns and then against support this specific bill. So there's major issues that are need to be addressed with youth in Alaska. According to the Pew Research Center, 1 in 5 teens are on TikTok and YouTube almost constantly. At the same time, 64% of teens say they use chatbots, and 3 in 10 who do say they use it nearly daily. Nearly all U.S. teens say they are using the internet daily, including 4 in 10 who say they are online almost constantly. According to kids spend a significant amount of time on screens, with average varying by age, teens reaching 7 to 9 hours per day, and tweens 8 to 12 around 4 to 6, not including schoolwork. You know, these numbers are just shocking to me, and it's really easy to see examples in our daily lives too. If you go to a high school event or you walk through the halls of the high school and just look and see how many teens are on their phones constantly or checking in, it's quite unbelievable. So I'm asking, you know, this committee and to take some action to help address these countries across the world are looking at the same things that we are. You're seeing bans like Australia, France, Denmark, Norway, and many more are considering different alternatives, you know, kind of similar to this. In the U.S., you know, the Senator Ted Cruz, you know, is leading a group that has introduced legislation to establish a minimum age to 13, and also working on this algorithm push to ban addictive content, kind of similar to some of the things in the bill. Additionally, we've got Arkansas, Florida, Louisiana, Missouri, Ohio, California, Utah, Texas, Kentucky that are, again, working on these different approaches to whether it's banning social media, prohibiting certain algorithm content, imposing liability on social media platforms for harm caused, you know, warning labels, all different approaches that are being taken. And so the big question here is, why is everybody trying to work on this? And I just want to focus on these points today and why I have such concern. One is the mental health concerns. You know, there's a significant correlation between social media usage, mental health risks. You know, higher rates of anxiety, depression have been linked to it. According to the Pew Research Center, 1 in 5 teens say social media harms their mental health, and growing numbers believe it harms harms people their age. Children compare themselves to unrealistic versions, you know, and it can affect their self-esteem and body image, among, you know, young girls. Some information provided says that, you know, more teens that are on social media and exposed to it, the more likely they are to have poor body image. Cyberbullying is another major concern. You know, you hear this a lot. Back in my day, you know, bullies couldn't, you know, back in my day, bullying still happened. Well, bullies couldn't follow you at home and kind of relentlessly torment you. Today, bullies can continue to bully you long after. Online bullying can be constant and anonymous, you know, making it harder to escape, you know, the bullying. I personally dealt with it, this, having to talk to parents and try to navigate them through some of these different things. I don't think children understand the full consequence of their actions, and giving this platform, these platforms to them to spread misinformation or attack others, you know, that's frightening to me. I think I heard someone mentioning the addictive concerns. I think that's huge, and the numbers speak for themselves, you know, and more studies are going to show this. And as we, you know, are learning, social media platforms are designed to keep, you know, users scrolling, and this can reduce attention spans, disrupt homework, you know, make it harder for kids to enjoy, you know, offline activities. States are taking action. You know, we see some litigation going on against Meta. You know, just in this last month, we saw some civil actions and some juries that found and held some companies accountable. Yeah, so there seems to be a strong negative correlation between time spent consuming, you know, short video content to attention spans. It can also impact sleep. So there's major concerns that I have. Exposure to inappropriate content. It's very difficult for parents to restrict what their kids see and censor it. So children can encounter all kinds of things we don't want, and the algorithms can really push unhealthy content. Reduce social skills. I think, again, people can kind of see this for themselves. Major privacy and safety concerns that children may overshare, and there's a risk of contact from strangers or predators. And the storage of the data, I mean, I just can't imagine when you have data on kids starting at 12 or 13 over the course of their life, you know, and again, if that data ever gets hacked or blackmailed. I have personal, you know, knowledge of you know, a young lady who got raped through, you know, talking to someone over a social media platform, that talking with her parents. So I don't want to minimize the, again, there's some opposing arguments to this from First Amendment, parental rights, you know, and there are some benefits of social media. But in my opinion, again, these negatives kind of outweigh a lot of the benefits. We have age-based regulations across the board, from movies to television, video games, gambling, websites, illicit content, alcohol, tobacco products, vaping, marijuana, driver's license, motor licenses. You can go on and on. And so I don't understand the idea that social media should be different. It also has, again, negative impacts. So I'm actually supportive of even a larger ban. But this is a great kind of start, and I hope that it passes.
Thank you so much for your testimony today. If it's okay, we're going to set House Bill 318 aside and bring it back up at a later date. But,
can I make one more
just
comment? You know, I appreciate everybody's questions, the invited testimony, everybody that came in. One of the things that I found interesting is, you know, I'm on the education committee, and I see a lot of kids whenever they come through the building and everything. And as I've wrote this and kind of started working on this, I thought I was going to be like, kids weren't going to like me. and I've actually found it quite surprising that every group of teens that I have met with, when you ask them, they'll ask like, hey, what are you working on? And I told them I got a social media ban, or not a ban, but a social media bill. They're surprisingly supportive of it. Yeah, we have a problem. Just 2 days ago, I had a group of teens in my office, five of them from the Kenai Peninsula, and they specifically said, yeah, we have a problem and we do need some help. And so I want to help them.
I believe you. And thank you, Representative Elam, for bringing this bill forward. Our final item of business is House Bill 64. I just want to say for committee members, we're going to go over. I understand that some of you may not be able to, and we'll just continue with me and whoever can stay. So our final item of business is House Bill 64, Surrender of Infants, Infant Safety Device, sponsored by Representative Tomaszewski and his staff, David Goff. As a reminder to the committee, at our last hearing on House Bill 64, we took up a committee substitute, but we did not adopt it. The committee substitute remains on the table, and we have some additional information and some additional testimony today. I would like to call my committee aide, Dylan Hitchcock-Lopez, to come forward and walk us through the statement of changes, and then we will hear from three invited testifiers.
Good afternoon. Dylan Hitchcock-Lopez, committee aide. I'm going to be very brief in the interest of time. I'm just going to go over just the technical changes from the previous version to the committee substitute because we didn't have time to do that at the last hearing. So the committee substitute adds four sections and a new title. The Section 1, which is the most substantive new section from the previous version, adds a new article to the statutes governing hospitals and nursing facilities. This would require hospitals and birthing facilities to provide confidential labor and delivery services upon request. It would allow individuals in labor to receive care under an assumed name, and it would prohibit the hospital from attempting to identify the individual except to collect health insurance information. It also requires hospitals to provide confidential birth patients with informational materials to be developed by the Department of Health, and it would impose a records-keeping requirement to safeguard patient confidentiality. Section 2, also new, is a tweak to the statute governing birth certificates. It adds a new subsection that provides that the name of an individual who gives birth confidentially and who surrenders the infant under existing safe surrender law may not be entered on the birth certificate. Section 3, new from the previous version, amends the statutes governing the examination and treatment of minors. There's a pre-existing statute that already allows minors to consent to medical treatment related to pregnancy. This would just explicitly include that confidential birth is among those treatments. And Section 3, which is the final new version, which is the final new version, adds a new subsection to the duties of the Department of Health that requires the department to publish information regarding confidential birth on its website and to develop some written informational materials for distribution to individuals who request to give birth confidentially. The remaining sections 5 to 9 are simply renumbered from the previous version. There are no substantive changes to those sections.
Thank you. And although my script says that we should ask for questions right now, because some of our invited testimony has hard deadlines, if it's okay with committee, we'll go to our three invited testifiers, and then we'll discuss the committee substitute. Our first invited testimony is from Dr. Lori Bruce. Dr. Bruce is a bioethicist and policy scholar. She is a research scientist at Yale University with deep experience in health policy. She has extensive legislative experience on issues related to children and families and has worked in many hospital settings to improve institutional policies. She has studied safe haven laws for over 12 years, partnering closely with indigenous communities, clinicians, and other key stakeholders. She has served on the National Safe Haven Task Force, and her work on the subject appears in Time Magazine and other media outlets. Dr. Bruce, please take yourself off mute, state your name and affiliation for the record, and provide your testimony.
Hello, everyone. My name is Lori Bruce, and I'm a research scientist at Yale University. I'm happy to provide testimony. I'm also happy to stay on this call to answer any questions or concerns that may come up, if that's helpful to you. I'm grateful for the chance to connect here today. And I want to start by saying that I share the goals of everyone in this room to help safeguard the lives of our most vulnerable infants. As mentioned, I've studied safe haven laws for over 12 years or so, and I work to identify ways to help fill the gaps which compromise the health and well-being of the infants and families and women that are impacted by these laws. And in all of my work, and certainly within Safe Haven, I partner closely with those who are impacted by policies, including tribal and indigenous communities throughout the U.S., clinicians, and other key stakeholders. So I've worked with many states on their Safe Haven laws. And so I hope I can be helpful in sharing some of the misperceptions and complexities related to policies that are seeking to reduce unsafe infant abandonment. Some of these policy solutions are actually quite ineffective and sometimes quite harmful And so in my work, I've reviewed studies that examine what really does indeed reduce the rate of unsafe abandonments and infanticides. And those studies examined the efficacy of baby boxes or baby hatches, as well as the efficacy of what some call confidential birth. I think what's important to share with you is that there are countries in Europe, for instance, that have implemented even 100 baby boxes, not because there was a high rate of unsafe abandonments, but because there was the desire to offer another policy option to perhaps save the life of even one infant. What was found in an analysis in that country, which was Germany, that even after 100 boxes were installed, the rates of unsafe abandonments and neonaticides did not budge. They did not change at all after those boxes were implemented. But what was noticed is that the boxes were used. And so that indicates that it's not that the use of boxes is actually cutting into the numbers of those who would have otherwise gone in person to a hospital or a fire station. So this means in at least some cases, we're seeing that, you know, at least in some places where it's been implemented, that boxes can reduce the provision of crisis counseling for the mom, reduce the frequency of medical care for the mom, inhibit the ability for the family to understand other choices that are available to them that could promote family preservation, could help them to understand support services that are available, because with an in-person visit, there's the chance to speak to the parent and let them decompress a little bit and help them understand what we refer to in modern medicine as true informed consent, the pillar of modern medicine. And so when a person in crisis only knows about one solution and they don't talk to anyone, they won't know about wonderful options that are out there for them, including temporary placement with licensed families that have the goal of reunification if the parent decides that's what's best for them. So I'm certainly not against boxes per se, but the way they've been implemented, I have seen it's very likely to decrease informed consent, decrease medical care for the mom, and likely lead to increased family separation. I'd be happy to prepare any sort of different kinds of documents for you, such as documents on common misperceptions or documents for patients to help them understand options that are available to them so that they are aware of the different kinds of choices that are open to them. So I thought I would just talk just a little bit about what confidential birth actually is. And if there's time, I'd love to share with you a short list of why the box solution is actually much more complicated and may indeed raise harms as opposed to sadly being able to contribute to a solution.
Dr. Bruce,
yes.
A question from Representative Kopp.
Yes. Thank you, Dr. Bruce. Dr. Bruce, you said in your review of this, I don't know if it was, you know, what type of, you know, was it an empirical research study where you used controls in looking at the efficacy of baby boxes, or are you basically summarizing anecdotal evidence that you saw?
Thank you. Thank you. That's a really great question. It was observational. And so it looked at the actual numbers of infanticides and unsafe abandonments before boxes were installed. And then it examined the same numbers after those boxes had been installed and in place for a while. And I'd be delighted to send you those studies and some other studies that I have found in Austria as well that speak to the efficacy around that.
Okay, just follow up. Yeah. Thank you. I really appreciate that answer. Then just a follow up. You mentioned that the 100 baby boxes in Germany, you believed
indicated that while they were used, you said your assumption was if those boxes hadn't been used, those mothers would have come in and had a delivery.
No, that those moms would have otherwise surrendered in person, because the numbers of unsafe abandonments didn't change at all, but the boxes were indeed being used, not a lot. By far the preferred option is always to come in by parents is to come in person because they want to see who they're giving their child to. It is believed by a number of scholars that when we see some box usage, but no change in the numbers of unsafe abandonments, it's believed that we're actually cutting into those parents actually going to the hospital and being able to receive in-person care.
Okay, thank you. I have to say, it seems counterintuitive to me because if somebody is going to go to the extreme measure of delivering to a box, that means they do not want to see anybody under any circumstance, and they are willing basically to let that baby die before they have to interface with the person. But because there is this option, they will use it. So I'm having trouble making the logical leap that they would otherwise go in and get counseling and things like that because, you know, from my experience in the emergency services background, the type of person that is going to do this is avoiding contact at basically all cost. And this is basically the only option they will consider to surrender an infant where they do not have to make a contact with a professional. So that's why I asked if it was anecdotal observations, because it seems like it's a logical leap to come to your conclusion that they otherwise would be getting more informed consent and more in services. I appreciate, you know, that you're coming from that, from your observation, but it's, to me, it seems counterintuitive. Thank you.
Thank you. That's a really, I'm so glad that you brought that up. And what's been seen is that, people use the policy options that they're aware of. And so if there are signs or posts on Department of Public Health or media advertisements about boxes, they think that's their solution. They're not in a place where they can slowly do an analysis and try to find out about all the options. But if they see that there is a box, there are people who will indeed use the box. If they're not aware of the box, or part of the problem is when boxes are implemented, there's often marketing funds by those who promote boxes to put up lots of advertising so that people know about it. And yet the more traditional in-person surrender, if there's ever advertising about that or publicity, it has to come from state funds. And so sometimes people don't know about that option, but when they know about this option, they do indeed use it. And we've seen that even here in my state, when we allocate certain funds for our in-person safe haven surrender, the numbers do indeed go up. And we've seen that in other jurisdictions as well. So there is this perception that there's a lot of shame around going to do an in-person surrender that may or may not necessarily be held up. But again, you know, there are different kinds of women that are subject to seeking these kinds of policies.
Dr. Bruce, I apologize. We're going to come back to hear about confidential birth and your list of reasons. We're going to go to our next two presenters since they are under time crunch. So our next invited testifier is Noelle Ozimek. Ms. Ozimek is the former director of research and development at the National Safe Haven Alliance, where she worked closely with women in crisis, considering alternatives to parenting, including safe newborn surrender. She has also collaborated with clinicians to enhance privacy protections for these women, many of whom have concerns about identifying themselves when giving birth. Ms. Ozimek, please take yourself off mute, state your name and affiliation for the record, and provide your testimony.
Hi, thank you for the introduction. Can you see me?
We cannot see you, but we can hear you very well.
Okay, well, I think that's what's important. I'll try and fix that after I'm done speaking. I will be really quick in the interest of time. But I'm Noelle Osmick. I'm the former director of research and development at the National Safe Haven Alliance, which is a nonprofit that functions to provide federal oversight to safe surrender programs. So I've worked with hundreds of women who are considering utilizing safe surrender and who are interested in learning about other options. So things like parenting their child or putting their child up for adoption. In my work with all of that, that's also really brought me to working with clinicians to implement enhanced privacy protections for patients whose safety could be at risk if their identities were disclosed. So really in practice, providers are already trying to navigate these situations and trying to get enhanced protections for their patients. They're doing the best that they can. And I think that even with that, it can be really tricky, and that this bill offers us an opportunity to formalize and standardize those protections. I also briefly wanted to touch on some pushback that we commonly get, which is there's a common belief that like HIPAA and EMTALA are enough and sufficient in this space. And in my experience, while these are really critical pieces of legislation, there are still needs for additional protections. I've seen people conceal their pregnancy from 9 months from abusers, from people that they have concerns about. And after doing that, people feel so committed to doing so that they feel like they have to stay home from the hospital. They can't risk someone finding out about their pregnancy. So just having that extra layer of protection to say like, no, we have an established process to help protect you, I think is really important in getting those people access to care. So I'm happy to share a bunch of stories where I think that this enhanced legislation would have helped in those situations. I also quickly want to touch on what was just said about how people who use a box, they wouldn't necessarily be interested in going to the hospital to give birth because they are just avoiding interaction with people at all cost. I think that, well, I understand that point. In my experience, that's not what I would expect. I think that birth is an incredibly dangerous situation to be in, and women know that. And so a lot of times when women, even if they're scared to go to the hospital, women will do so if they have like any inkling that that is what's necessary, even if that means that they have to drive an hour or drive a couple hours to be able to access care. Of course, when we talk about anonymous birth, we have to accept that there are some women who will still stay home and that expanded protections are needed. But I did just want to dispute the point. I don't think that the population of people who utilize boxes and would utilize anonymous birth, I don't think that that's contradictory to each other.
Thank you, Dr. Ozimek. In the interest of time, we need to go to our third testifier, and then we'll come back and ask questions. We will now hear from Dr. Ann Zink. Dr. Zink is an emergency medicine physician and the former chief medical officer for the state of Alaska. Dr. Zink, please take yourself off mute, put yourself on the record, and begin your testimony.
Yes, thank you so much, Chairman and members of the committee, and thank you for the opportunity to testify and really on your guys' work on behalf of children. I am not here to testify in opposition or really necessarily in clear support of HB 64, but I am here on behalf of supporting every precious child in the state. I just wanted to share a few thoughts on my experience as an emergency medicine physician, as a public health provider in Alaska, and in working in government, and to make sure that the laws that you pass hopefully can be as useful as possible. So as we have talked about, what we know is that we do have a Safe Haven Act on the books since 2008, allowing parents to safely surrender infants 21 days old and younger to a hospital employee, peace officer, community health aide, firefighter, EMS, no questions asked. As Fire Chief Sturgis testified yesterday, it sounds like there is no legal requirement to collect identifying information, and the questionnaire is entirely voluntary. So it's great that we have that framework. And things that we can build off of. A few gentle concerns I have about this. First of all, I worry about cost. From what I found online, each baby box runs approximately $20,000 for the device for installment, electrical, alarm hookup, and training, plus $500 annual fee. And when I was looking at the data, I could find that a single patent holder and that company shows a $4.4 million revenue last year. And while I understand the bill carries zero fiscal notes, the boxes would be privately funded, I worry about the amount of unfunded mandate on communities, particularly our smaller and rural communities, volunteer fire departments that may feel pressure to install and maintain these devices without dedicated resources. And what happens when those dollars go away, the company goes bankrupt, and daily checks by first responders are required, which in rural Alaska is a real operational burden. I worry about where the dollars could go differently. When I think about $20,000 per box, how many home visits I could fund, how many months of residential treatment for a mother and baby that we could support that we don't really have in the state, and how many safe seat clips we could distribute or prenatal screenings for domestic violence. I'm not saying it's one way or the other, but I'm saying with a state with limited resources, enormous geography, thinking about where we can invest those dollars. I worry about the baby. As a medical provider, the newborn state is incredibly fragile and minutes matter. An infant who's been exposed to substance use in utero, is premature, may have undiagnosed conditions, needs a medical assessment. And a climate-controlled box temperature does do temperature regulation, but does not provide anything for that clinical evaluation. And while that may work quickly to get someone in Anchorage, that would be very different in many parts of our state. A box does not mean safety. And when a baby's handed off to a firefighter or a nurse, they can take a look at that baby, see if something's wrong, and act. And the box really essentially removes that first human contact. And as talked about before, I worry about the mother. When a mother places her baby in a box and walks away, there's no any opportunity for someone to ask, are you safe? Do you need help? And we know from the data that when we take a moment, that woman in a stressful situation, it tends to be because they are experiencing substance use, domestic violence, or both. And a face-to-face surrender, even brief, carries the moment for potential connection. And that box forecloses that possibility. A handout isn't the same thing as a hug, and a list of resources outside of box is not the same thing as a caring exchange. What the data tells us about protecting children in Alaska, it's not to say that this bill does not protect children, and there could be real space there, but as an emergency physician, remember caring for a woman who arrived with a serious pregnancy complication months after avoiding all medical care, as was previously talked about. She did not want to come in. She was planning to surrender her baby, not because she didn't care about the child, but because she didn't want, or not because she didn't want the baby, but because she was terrified. And she was terrified of stigma and judgment, of a positive drug screen, and not being able to find care for her child. And by the time she reached us, her options were limited, and she didn't know of other options out there. And once she did, she chose to engage in them. That woman didn't need a box. She needed a system that made her feel safe to get help for both her and her baby. I also want to point out that substance use is a stronger predictor for child welfare involvement, and Alaska's ALCAM Link Project is a nationally recognized data linkage program that connects birth records, PRAM survey, and child welfare records that shows that maternal substance use has the largest impact on how and when child protective services contact the family. And investing in that and figuring out ways that we can reduce stigma and keep women from seeking to need to feel like they're abandoning and being able to have treatment is incredibly informative and useful. Investing in the ALCAM Links project itself and public health infrastructure supports babies and protects mothers and families, and I do believe leads to significant returns. We have real success stories with alcohol. We talked a lot just previously on other testimony about what patients know about and what we don't know about. Sustained public education about the risks of alcohol during pregnancy, including programs such as the Alaska FAS Prevention Program, is contributing to meaningful declines in prenatal alcohol use. Alaska's legalized restriction of recreational marijuana has been in place, but we've not invested in comparable public health education about cannabis in pregnancy or the safe surrender laws. And the CDC reports that prenatal cannabis use is associated with lower birth weight. One of eight states that did use PRAM data to look at supplemental information to understand marijuana and efforts to do there. And we continue to see from the EPI bulletins that unsafe sleep remains the leading cause of death for infants in the state. So I understand there's a lot of discussion about lists of resources. I appreciate the instinct, but I continue to encourage us to think about the underlying challenge of making sure that we're supporting every precious life in the state and thinking about where our dollars can be used and served as closely as possible. So I'd encourage the committee to consider supporting investments in what we know works, education on safe surrender laws like we have in the state, prenatal screening for substance use and domestic violence, public education on cannabis and pregnancy, supporting family-centered treatment, sustaining funds for Alaska's ALCAM Link Project, continuing to focus on Healthy Beginnings program, looking at the ways that we can use the rural health transformation dollars to effectively really improve Healthy Beginnings, which offers a real opportunity for a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to focus on mothers and babies. And I believe the community wants the same thing. We want every baby in Alaska to be safe and healthy and thriving, and mothers to have the support that they need. So thanks for your thoughtfulness on this issue, and I welcome any questions.
Thank you, Dr. Zink. I will start with a question for you. When you mentioned that there are pregnant moms who may be afraid to go to the hospital because of the drug test, do you have any ideas about ways that we could get that mom to go to the hospital?
Chair Gray, I appreciate the question, and I think that this also came up. So Chair Coffin, like the times that we see an EMS in the emergency department, are people really avoiding any sort of medical intervention whatsoever. Oftentimes in talking to patients, and I actually did call a couple of our state's experts in thinking about Office of Children's Services and thinking about this prenatal space, it is oftentimes a fear of either a report of OCS and having that child taken away from them or trying to kind of get through their pregnancy, or feeling completely overwhelmed and unsure of what to happen in the moment. So that's why I continue to think about ways that we can support mothers and babies to be able to try to continue that connection, thinking about things like this isn't a perfect analogy, but the drug court system in which we enable people who are struggling with an addiction in a harm reduction manner to get treatment rather than just penalizing. And so I think that there is a lot more we can do both in the education on cannabis, safe surrender laws, and potentially an intermediary before reporting to Office of Children's Services for something like marijuana in the system that may lead to a decrease in reports to OCS, but then also in a way that we're making sure mothers and babies are supported. I always like to think of what's right for the patient and the rest is noise. So I think about what do we do best for moms and babies, and then how do we move backwards from there to create legislation and policy to support that.
Thank you, Dr. Zink. We have Matthew Thomas, a nurse consultant for the Division of Healthcare, online for questions. And I'm wondering if he can answer a question about what happens when a mom, a pregnant woman, shows up at the ER in labor and is positive for either illicit substances or marijuana. Does law enforcement immediately get involved? Does OCS get involved? How does that look currently in Alaska?
For the record, Matthew Thomas, nurse consultant to Division of Healthcare Services. Through the chair, to answer your question, that would be outside the scope for me to answer, and however would be an internal facility policy in conjunction with reporting requirements to OCS, for example.
Okay, thank you. Dr. Zink, can you talk about how that normally happens in the ER?
Yeah, Representative Gray, to the chair, as an ER physician, my first and foremost focus is the health and well-being of that mother, not what is in the system and what is happening. So I would just support them in the moment they're look like they're in delivery. Usually that means quickly getting them over to OB and doing all that we can to support mom and baby in that moment, or if they had delivered home. So that is in the emergency department, 100% of all of our focus. I do sit on a committee at MAPDU that reviews all of the cases of child abuse and things that are referred to OCS. It is amazing how many cases we have of a positive urine drug screen of marijuana, where they're fairly quickly screened out, their support services sent to families and patients. I would encourage the committee to discuss, Dr. Kathy Baldwin-Johnson is an expert in this area, thinking a lot about the space. But we are legally mandated reporters. So if we are concerned that child is at risk, we are legally mandated to report that. So if a mother is found to be under the influence, we are legally mandated to report that. That when the timing of that comes is usually well after the stabilization of mom and baby, but does not mean that does not impact that mom and that baby and their future, which could mean getting law enforcement involved both in the hospital or later.
Thank you. I will open up questions to all of our invited testimony. Are there any questions from committee members?
Representative, I have one, but
sure. Representative Kopp.
Yeah. It seems, any invited testifier can take this question, but, it seems like we're discussing the ideal which, you know, there's clearly a bias in every single invited testifier towards the healthcare system, which I think is great. You guys are healthcare professionals, and we want people to have access to healthcare. But all three of you also know that over 100 million Americans do not have a primary healthcare provider. They don't even take care of themselves. A lot of people with insurance, it's, you know, maybe 90% of the country has some access to healthcare. A huge part of that number would be a very, very low quality, I would throw out there. But 100 million people don't see a primary healthcare provider. So it seems that you're framing your view of this option of dropping off a child from the perspective as you really want to see the patient in person, which I totally get. That's the ideal. But the very nature of this bill is it's addressing the reality of what's really happening, is that the people don't want to see a primary healthcare provider. They don't even see one themselves. And they had this baby already outside of the help of a primary healthcare provider, but they don't want it to die. So it's simply allowing an option for dropping off. And so I just wanted to point out there is a clear bias from a layperson's perspective in your wanting people to engage the healthcare profession, which I sincerely appreciate it. I have a son who's a surgeon, so I'm all with you on that. But that's not what this bill is about. This bill addresses the reality of the one-third of Americans that are not only not seeing a healthcare provider, but are highly unlikely if they're not taking care of themselves that way, that they would, in a situation where they've already given birth to a baby, not utilize this option. So it's a comment. I invite any one of you to respond, but it's an observation.
Thank you. I would like all three testifiers to respond.
Representative Koff, through the chair. Can you guys hear me?
Yes.
Am I unmuted? Great. Awesome. Sounds good. Thank you. I so appreciate that comment. And as an ER physician, I could not agree more. Yes, I would
love for
everyone to have primary. Sorry, my name is Dr. Ann Zink. I just want to say, like, I really agree, and I applaud the committee for looking for solutions outside the healthcare system. And yeah, I am biased as an emergency medicine physician and want people to have that access and what that looks like. But I oftentimes say the emergency department is where all good public policy comes to fail. And we see where there are those systems and lack of infrastructure and space, and applaud the committee on finding ways outside of the system, as well as thinking about how to support the system to support children, babies from not dying. I think my larger concern is thinking about my role when I worked at the department on maintaining the EMS kind of structure. And are we doing that? And that's a tough question that you all get to wrestle with. And I just think about the implications of kind of unfunded mandates and making these things happen, and what happens if the funds change, and the programmatic work that has to go on in the Department of Health on the back end for the long term when legislation passed, and how do we continue to move forward. So I guess I just would like to echo and appreciate your comment and want to find ways outside of the healthcare system to support individuals to make the best decisions that they can, as well as easy access to the health system when they need it. And we are a long way from that. So I really agree.
Thank you. Dr. Ozemek.
Hi, yes. This is Noelle Ozmek. I would say that the fact that we have people not interacting with our healthcare system is exactly why we need anonymous birth legislation. We need legislation to make healthcare accessible to everyone as we possibly can. And we know that people are avoiding coming to clinics. So why not do what we can to improve accessibility? When it comes to the baby box piece of this legislation, yes, that is a good point. I would say that I would offer some alternatives to maybe baby boxes in the way that we know them. For example, some hospitals have been successful in implementing baby drawers, or having corners of hospitals where you go in like a back entrance and you can leave a child there. And at least it's inside of a hospital and it's not a untested box connected to the side of the building. So I do think that if those are the concerns that some people don't want to interact with providers, there are alternatives to the boxes that are being discussed that are more ethical and also still accessible to individuals who need that.
Thank you. Dr. Bruce.
Thank you so much.
I mean, I do agree at some level that I may perhaps prefer in person because, but the reasons I do is because when we see those cases come in, we see it gives them the opportunity to be able to interact. But it's really more my recommendations are really more based on what the studies have indicated in terms of what are interventions that have actually been shown to be successful at reducing neonaticides and unsafe abandonments. And when we look at that list of policies, boxes have never demonstrated the ability to reduce those numbers. So, you know, I'm not anti-box, and I think in certain policy climates, they may indeed be helpful. I have a lot of concerns about boxes, including some unintended harms and consequences that I'd be happy to discuss. But I do agree with the other two invited speakers. And, you know, there's also some states have also had good luck in rolling out through the 911 system. Someone can call and say that they would like to safe haven their baby, and then a paramedic can meet them at a location at a time that is safe and viable for them. You know, some of these folks already have other children, and sadly, the reason they're surrendering relates to family dynamics and not wishing to bring in another child where there might be abuse or lack of funding. Being able to have that option with the paramedic is another viable option. So, I'm happy to go through my list of reasons why boxes are not as straightforward and really do pose many risks. But I want to try to just stick to the question at hand at the moment.
We're going to come back to you. I would like to ask a question. I think it might be to Ms. Ozimek. Can you talk about sex trafficking and coercion and a woman who might be in an abusive relationship who could be forced to surrender her infant to a box where that would, you know, be in the best interest of the sex trafficker or the abuser, whereas handing over to a live person would pose a potential intervention that the box is not allowing?
Sure. So I think the case of sex trafficking and abuse is really really complicated, and honestly, it's case dependent, because you'll see some people who are experiencing sex trafficking or domestic violence that will go to the hospital, even if those are things that they are actively experiencing, and get care. And you also know that there's a high risk that they don't go to the hospital, and get care. So it really is situation dependent, whether or not that person chooses to use a box. Obviously, if they're using a box, they're not presenting in the hospital. And we know that hospitals are really good points of where we can start interventions. There's so much data behind that. So utilizing a box takes that opportunity to intervene away. So I think that's some place where anonymous birth can really help bridge the gap, because like I said, it was surprising to me all the times I saw it, the amount of people in these situations who actually do go to the hospital. And so we really need to do everything we can to bring them to the hospital and get that intervention in early. Using a box, obviously, we lose that opportunity.
Thank you. Representative Mina.
Thank you, Chair Gray. Through the chair to Dr. Ozimek. Have there been other states that have passed anonymous birthing laws? I know it is something that happens in many European countries, as you mentioned.
There's no states. Lori could talk a little bit more about the countries if you're interested in it internationally. With that being said, versions of anonymous birth are like still being practiced. So we could think about things like some hospitals will have VIP policies, so that if you're famous, you can enter into the hospital under a pseudonym, and they don't put your name on like the call boards. They don't put your name outside of your like the board of your room, things like that. So other states have
basically expanded those protections and utilized hospital procedure, or other hospitals, I would say, have utilized those procedures in cases where anonymous birth is requested, and those have been super successful. So no, there's no state that formally has it like written into law, but there are definitely hospital settings that are practicing versions of this other under currently existing procedures.
As a follow-up?
Sure.
Through the chair, you had also mentioned, Dr. Uzemek, that in some cases where you have a survivor and an abuser, that there might be a situation where the person wants to give birth anonymously and have their record be protected so that the abuser doesn't find out, but there is an inability to do that. Could you expand more on that situation?
Yeah, so I wouldn't say that there is an inability to do that. to protect those records, as much as just the system that we have now is flawed. So an example I can give is one time I worked with someone who was college age. She was over 18. She got pregnant and she knew her parents were going to disown her if they knew. So she wanted to give birth in a hospital, and then she was planning to put the baby up to be surrendered. And she ended up doing so, but then her insurance company sent an explanation of benefits to her parents' house, and that's how her parents found out. And that's where I think anonymous birth legislation and the education that we would be doing with physicians to support this legislation would really have helped prevent that from happening. Because, you know, under HIPAA, there's other alternatives to getting an explanation of benefits sent to your house. So you can request that it's sent to like an alternative address, or that you get receive information via phone call. That's already, like I said, inscribed in HIPAA. So if we had anonymous birth legislation that helped spread awareness for that, then maybe this situation where her parents found out about a pregnancy wouldn't have happened.
Thank you.
Thank you. Eddie's.
Sure. So I'm supposed to be giving a presentation.
Back on the record, for the record, we were joined by Senator Myers at 3:26 p.m. So I see, Dr. Bruce, you have your hand up. And Dr. Bruce, we could hear from you your
I did not mean to raise my hand. I'm here as needed.
But you know what? We're going to try to finish up in the next 5 or so minutes. Let's hear your list of reasons why you don't like the baby boxes. And if you can answer Ms. Ozemek's suggestion that you talk about all the countries that have some sort of anonymous or confidential birth.
Sure. And I would say it's not so much that I like the boxes or not. I mean, as a policy person, what I try to do is I try to see which policies have demonstrated success, and see whether, and also to examine for any group of constituents, are the different types of constituents' needs being met. So it's not whether, you know, I like them or not. And I'm happy to provide the list of all the countries. There are 11 other countries that offer something called confidential birth or anonymous birth. And, you know, I'd love to even just take the time to define what that means, because sure, people roll it out in lots of different ways that I would not want to see in the U.S. context. And so, you know, the list is France, Austria, Italy, Belgium, Luxembourg, Germany, the Netherlands, Czech Republic, Japan, and South Korea. But I think what's really important when we're thinking about confidential birth is to not Google it or Google anonymous birth and see how others have done it. But for us, it would be three things in the U.S. context. It would be the ability to receive labor and delivery within a hospital or birthing center without having to disclose your identity. And that can be done through existing hospital policies, like our hospital has an alias policy, so that when famous people or the CEO is receiving medical care, all of the people around aren't aware of that and it becomes distracting. It's also been really helpful when there's a member of a gang being treated. It's much safer for a hospital to not have that person's actual name on the registry, right? And so it's, there's a way of already providing an extra layer of confidentiality that many hospitals already do that we'd be piggybacking on in this case, to be able to allow, and often you can even still see that person's chart, you would just provide an alias so that, they would see the medical record and so forth, but she would go by a different name while she was there. So first off, that just simply that being able to give birth without being pestered, you have to give us your name. Secondly, it would be while she's there giving birth to give her some amount of crisis counseling so that she is comforted, because we're aware that this is a very stressful time. And then thirdly, to provide true informed consent, because as mentioned before, it's taken me years to know all of the different options that are available in this time of crisis, but there are many, including some that are, different forms of temporary placement. And I spent about an hour and a half on the phone with some folks at a nonprofit in Alaska that do indeed offer a local version of what the National Organization Safe Families for Children provides, to allow temporary placement without having to go in the foster care system, with the hopes of reunifying if that's what would be best for that family, that child, and that mom. So again, confidential birth isn't talking about, like, are we taking the name off the birth certificate? Are we definitely surrendering? Are we going to adoption? It is really just encapsulating this little tiny moment to allow this woman to come to the hospital and give birth, and without having to disclose her identity. And then after that, she could go through all of the other legally permissible options. But confidential birth is really just a little bit further upstream in the policy cycle. And the reason it's a good idea is because it has been demonstrated in 11 other countries to indeed reduce the risks of unsafe abandonment, and that women want this. And that it's much safer for the woman, and it is certainly safer for the baby, because there's tons of documented studies showing that unattended births are very unsafe for baby.
Thank you. Any other questions from committee? Representative Vance?
I don't have any questions, Mr. Chairman. I have some comments, if that's permissible at this time.
Yes.
Thank you. The vice chair was very, very diplomatic, and I'm searching for that right now, because the more testimony that was provided, the more I stand in opposition to the committee substitute. I think I know where your heart is on the committee substitute. However, I want this committee and the public to remember that Alaska recently had two newborns die from abandonment. One of them was found on the side of the road and the other was frozen to death. I understand that the medical community wants women to go to the hospital. However, for whatever reason, mothers are not doing that. We have incredible opportunities for them to get free healthcare coverage. We have safe haven that they can surrender their baby right now. But what we don't have is a warm baby box that will alert the medical community that there is a baby that needs to be rescued and give them an opportunity to live. That to me is we don't need to say, no, we don't need baby boxes because we need to send these women to have a safer birth. we have options for women, but I have constituents in my community who have such an incredible distrust of hospitals and the medical community that they will not go. They will not. And I think that's what this bill aims to address, to save the life of babies, to give give an option that we are not providing right now. I want women to go and have safe, healthy births. But I also want to solve an issue that Alaska is facing right now. And I take offense to our former chief medical officer speaking against the baby boxes, saying that that's an unfunded mandate and the complications that that could provide when it could save the lives of infants. When there are organizations who say, we will put the money there. There are grandparents and people in the community who say, we will donate the money to keep these going because we think that every life is precious. So I appreciate the dialogue, Mr. Chairman, because there are areas that need to be solved. But just simply providing the baby boxes is something that we can do.
Thank you, Representative Vance. And I will speak to some of what you said. And first of all, I just have to say for the record that Dr. Anzik has dropped off the line, so she cannot respond. I think that she was very explicit. So I'm just going to play that she was not speaking for or against, but she was speaking about her concerns. One of the concerns that she raised, and I'd be curious if you're committed to only doing the baby box that's been patented by this one particular person in the lower 48. Because I think we've heard from other examples of like the back door to the fire station. Is somebody who dislikes the medical establishment so much willing to surrender the baby at the back door of a fire station? I just think the idea that we're going to do a $20,000 a year baby box sponsored by, I believe, a woman in Arizona, that that's the only version that we can do. I instinctively have skepticism about us doing a piece of legislation that has been written by somebody in the lower 48 to encourage a subscription to their business. And that may not be true. And I'm happy to be educated that there's lots of baby box versions and we can choose one for ourselves or we can create our own. I'm happy to do that. I just have a lot of anxiety about doing cookie cutter legislation from Arizona that puts $4 million of profit into one particular company's coffers. And so, you know, take babies and moms out of it. I instinctively recoil to having Alaska do that. I'm happy. And I want to be clear about the CS. The CS did not do anything to baby boxes. Baby boxes were still there. This was adding on. Maybe there's one mom who's like, you know what? I'm under the influence of drugs and I'm afraid of being interacting with law enforcement. And so I'm going to give birth behind this dumpster and then put this baby in this box. But maybe if we had some way of communicating to her, you can go to the hospital and you can give birth and we'll take care of you and your baby. And we're not going to call the police. I want to think about that example. How can we, and I tried to ask that question. And I don't feel like I got a direct answer on how do we, is there something that we can do in policy to allow pregnant mothers who might be under the influence of drugs who are purposely avoiding medical care because they don't want to get in trouble, not because they aren't concerned about the health of their baby? And I don't know how to cross that. I'm interested in learning more about how to do that. And maybe anonymous birth isn't the answer. Maybe there's something else that we can do, some sort of immunity or something to allow that mom to not be afraid to get some medical care for herself and her baby. So that maybe so that they both don't die. So I know that people have been really frustrated with me about asking lots and lots of questions about the baby boxes, but I've had a lot of concerns about the baby boxes because I don't want an abused woman to feel pressured to put her baby in a box. I don't want people who, for other reasons, are choosing not to access medical care. And if we could figure out what those other reasons are and try to ameliorate them, it would be in the best interest of mommy and baby. And that's kind of what I'm trying to get to.
Are you waiting for a response, Mr. Chairman?
Well, I guess I just wanted to, do you hear where I'm coming from?
I do. But as I look at the table right here, I do. I'm having a selfish moment of reflection about who here has actually delivered babies and been in that place. And it's me. And I think it's a great place to go, but I just don't want it to be conflated with the single issue of what we could do. If writing the legislation to where it isn't helping one particular company, that's fine. However, it's not state dollars that would be doing that. It would be private donations. And what if this is the one company that said, I want to solve this problem on how we could safely make baby boxes? I don't know. We definitely don't want to be a partnership to someone, you know, exploiting people who have a heart to save babies, right? But it's filling a need. And that's something to keep in mind, because we're, as far as I know, the language is written for a type of baby box that can send the proper alerts to public safety. And, you know, in a small farm town in Illinois, they had a baby box there at the town square. And it was, you know, I was just walking with my daughter and noticed it. And there wasn't advertising that had to happen. You know, just walking downtown, I saw that it was there and available. And so I think this is an option that we should consider in just the simplicity of it. Sometimes we don't have to solve every problem on every piece of legislation.
Thank you, Representative Mina. Oh, you know what, Senator, you can come forward, put yourself on the record. And
thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Robert Meyer, Senator for District Q. I've got SB9, the companion to HB64. I just immediately, if you've got other questions, I'm happy to answer them. But immediately, I just wanted to talk about the genesis of the legislation a little bit, as Rep. Tomaszewski and I were working on it a couple of years ago. The company you're referencing from Indiana, we did not contact them. We were aware of their literature. We were made aware of it by some folks locally, but we did not contact them in drafting this legislation. It is not meant to be exclusive to that particular manufacturer. It is accurate that manufacturer has almost all of the baby boxes in America. I believe there's one baby box in the entire country that does not come from them. There is another company from Canada that also makes these baby boxes that would also satisfy this legislation. To the best of my knowledge, they do not do business in America yet. I do not know why, but their box would also fit this legislation. There are some other companies in Europe that make them as well. We didn't look as closely at them, and so I'm not 100% certain that their boxes would fit the legislation as written, but I don't believe that they're super different. When we drafted this legislation, it was, here is what needs to be in here in order to keep a baby safe, not here is the specifications for this company. There was no commercial intent here. There was no lobbying by this out-of-state company to allow for their boxes. I had two groups approach me, one from Fairbanks who approached Fairbanks Memorial Hospital and wanted to install one with their own money. And the hospital lawyers told them no, because current safe surrender law requires surrendering to a person, not with a device. And the second is Anchorage Fire Department, who wants to put one in because, as Representative Vance mentioned, they had two babies that were abandoned in Anchorage that perished, one of which was abandoned a block away from an Anchorage fire station. So the back door of the fire station, as you mentioned, is already an option. That is effectively what the current safe surrender law is. But unfortunately, some mothers don't want to see another person in this type of situation. So that's the option that we're trying to provide.
Thank you, Senator Myers. Representative Mina.
Thank you, Chair Gray. I just have a few general comments. You know, we heard this bill in the Health and Social Services Committee as well, and I think it's important to figure out holistically how we can work together as a legislature to help promote better family planning, better access to healthcare services, and making sure that babies and those families are adequately supported. And not all of these different pieces are mutually exclusive. I think I would be more concerned with this legislation if we were in a state that had far more limited access to different types of family planning services and education. And so I just think more options and more education is important as we talk about how we best care for the safety of the parent and the child. noting concerns about the particular business, Safe Haven, it's not delineated in the bill. It is specific about just expanding how we do safe surrender in the state so that it's not just to a particular individual. I was intrigued by some of the testimony, especially one individual bringing up calling 911 to have a paramedic come to you to pick up the baby and have an anonymous surrender that way. And I actually think that would be more convenient than the baby box, depending on if he had a phone or not. So I think we need just generally more education about first safe surrender and how it works, but also making sure that people who are in that position know that there are other options and services that are out there. And I think I was previously interested in having an amendment to make sure that we had some sort of health information, health and safety information on the box so that there is that step. But I think all of these different strategies together can help prevent infant mortality.
Thank you, Representative Mina. And I, too, am intrigued by 911 and having a paramedic come and get the baby. I will go to Senator Myers, and then I see that our invited testifiers have their hands up. We'll go to you, and then I'll go to the two invited testifiers, and then we'll wrap it up. Or do you have one? Okay, and then we'll go to Aishai, and then we'll wrap it up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to clarify to Representative Mina's comment, calling 911 to ask a paramedic to come to so you can surrender your baby, that is already allowed under current safe surrender law. So it's not something that we have to make allowances for. It's already there.
Well, to Representative Mina's point, no, we didn't know that. And so I'm guessing a 19-year-old giving birth may not know that either. We'll go to Ms. Ozimek, and then Dr. Bruce, and then Representative Aishai.
Yeah, so in addition to 911 surrender...
Can you place yourself on the record?
Oh, yes. This is Noelle Osmek.
Thank you.
In addition to 911 surrender, something else that I've done multiple times and that would be legal under your safe haven law is when women would call us and they were scared to go into a hospital, we would say, like, okay, we'll call the hospital for you and have someone come out and meet you in the parking lot. And that is legal under the safe surrender law, and it avoids women having to go in. People have, you know, put babies down in bassinets on benches and stepped back a couple feet and during the nighttime just so you couldn't see their face. And a nurse has come out and they've watched that handover. So at least there's continuity in care that way. So that is another option. And more education about that, I think, could really be life-saving. I think that, you know, you mentioned that a lot of the institutions that were interested in implementing boxes in Alaska were healthcare institutions. So I guess I don't really see this as much different than that. If someone's willing to go to a hospital to use a box, would they not be willing to, you know, cover their face and meet a nurse outside and do a handover?
Thank you. Dr. Bruce.
Hi, this is Lori Bruce. First off, Connecticut has an annual Safe Haven Day, and that helps to raise awareness. And so that's something you might wish to consider. I'd be happy to talk about how we structure that, but it really does help to get the word out. Secondly, the boxes by the main supplier in the U.S. are rented and not bought. So that $20,000 bill will keep coming back to you. Something to consider. Policy options like confidential birth and in-person safe haven do indeed succeed when they are publicized. That has been demonstrated. There are existing data points that say they actually do indeed reduce the rates of unsafe abandonment. That is a well-known point from research. When you rent a box from the main company, you don't just get a box. And I'm not sure if you'd be able to use a box from another company because the main company is the one that has a patent on it. So you just want to be careful about that if you're considering other options. But the main company doesn't just bring the box. They also then start to offer free educational sessions within high schools. But having personally viewed their training videos,
when I've watched them, I've never seen within the videos any sort of suggestion that would say, reach out to a trusted adult or consider talking to, you know, your parents or consider talking to a school counselor or anything like that. It's really, they implicitly recommend through these vignettes presented in their videos to give birth at home alone with a friend and then surrender in the box. So you're getting that free education when you bring this company into your state. I have also personally visited boxes and they are not anonymous. And Noel and I have, you know, done research on this too. And there are cameras all over. I've tried approaching some of these boxes and avoiding a camera, and I was unable to. And I visited one in particular last year, and I knocked on the door. I rang the bell. It took me over half an hour to find anyone there because all of the firefighters were out on call. The people I did find there were two electricians who had shut off the electricity, and they had no knowledge of the boxes, and they had no idea when the firefighters would be coming back. So the electrical supply to the boxes may have indeed been cut off because they didn't know what boxes were, but they had disabled the electricity. You may be careful if you're going to be looking at boxes from Europe, because I believe it was last December, an infant, a healthy infant, did indeed die after having been left in a box for 4 hours because no one checked on the box and the alarm failed. And the baby froze to death. Also, the boxes, as they are used, parents don't know that they can't get their children back. Parents don't know that they're being locked into a safe haven law. So if you do decide to go with boxes, it would be really beneficial to help parents understand the implications of their actions and all of their choices that are available to them. The hotline, there's a hotline, a free hotline that is offered by the main box company. And it may indeed embrace the values of certain folks in Alaska, but it may rub against the beliefs of many others in your state. And when the hotline is advertised, it's often advertised for anyone who's pregnant. So it's called by women at all stages of pregnancy. And when women don't feel safe or accepted by listening to someone whose religious beliefs may be quite different from theirs, they may lose trust in policy options, and it might further distance them from healthcare, when what we're really trying to do is offer policy solutions that are agnostic to any sort of religious leanings, and just to really be able to support everyone however they come to us when they're in crisis. Also, I have seen contracts with the box company that forbid you to edit any of the signage placed by the company without their permission. And I know that I know a commissioner in one state that really wanted to put a sign next to a box that says, you have other legally permissible options. But they weren't allowed to do that because of the contract that had been signed. You may know that there's no independent testing or regulation despite the criticality of the heating unit. And I was a part of an open letter signed by 100 scholars and clinicians who are very worried about that and asked the Department of Health and Human Services to please review boxes and make sure that they are safe. What's horrifying about all of this is that we can roll out all of these policies, and there will always be some numbers, low numbers, but there will always be some numbers of unsafe abandonments. And these are mostly from moms who are struggling with a myriad of problems, including psychiatric challenges. But these are moms that aren't even organized enough to use a box. And so that's a tragedy in all of this. But, you know, with many different policy options, we can try to get that number as low as possible. There's so much to say about this issue. It's very complicated. It's very nuanced. And sadly, there are many harms that can be brought upon those who potentially use any of these options, which is why I often work really closely with states, sometimes on year-long task forces, to kind of help them to decrease harms and increase awareness. So I appreciate all your time. And please know you can reach out to me at any time for questions or access to literature and so forth.
Thank you, Dr. Bruce. And thank you to all of our invited testifiers. I'll ask Senator Myers if he wants to say anything, or his staff, Teresa, or we're joined by Representative Tomaszewski at 3:55 p.m. And big thanks to committee members who've stayed, and big thanks to our staff. And I forgot that Representative Eichheit has been waiting with a question. Representative Eichheit.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Gray. It's more a request. You know, this has been a really interesting conversation. I've learned a lot because I've not had a birth myself, and been involved with that. And I think one of the things that I would request, one of the testifiers mentioned research. I would love to get some access to all the research that's been done on baby boxes and how they work, how well they have worked or not. It would be informative for me. So just that request.
Thank you. My staff, Dylan Hitchcock Lopez, will upload research to BASIS. Yes, to the sponsors. If you would like to give some final closing remarks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, for the record, Robert Myers again. So what it's just a couple things I want to get to. I know that we're near the end of time here, and I really hope that we've got our version coming over. Just got right across the House floor today, so I look forward to a full committee hearing on that soon. Couple things I want to just say. One, the baby in Europe that passed away, yes, that was in Italy 2 years ago. Tragic case. It was a case of a homemade box. The alarm failed. That alarm was set up to go off when the box was closed. This bill specifies that the alarm is supposed to go off when the box is first opened. So at an earlier stage, so if the box doesn't close, the alarm is still going off. It was a homemade box, not something manufactured. In the version that you will see coming from the Senate, we do have some language in there about monthly and yearly inspections of the box. So we are trying to take care of the safety side of it. And then finally, Mr. Chair, a lot of very interesting conversation. We were listening to some of it in the office before I came down here. Ultimately, what we're looking at here with this bill, this bill is not a question of do we prefer a baby in an infant safety device versus a baby turned over to a firefighter. This is not about a baby. Do we prefer a baby in an infant safety device to a baby anonymously given up in a hospital? Something along those lines. Ultimately, what this legislation is about is a baby in an infant safety device or a baby in a dumpster. Those are the options that we are looking at here with three infants that have in the last 15 years that have been abandoned on the side of the road. Fortunately, one in Fairbanks was found. I was actually contacted this morning by the woman who was the custody that baby was turned over to, and she has now adopted him. And I am hoping that she can come testify for us. But then we do still have the two in Anchorage that passed away. We recognize that nothing in life is perfect, and in some dire situations like this, there's a lot of different ways to address the situation. I am concerned that if we go too far down this rabbit hole, that we're going to run into not only implementation issues, but also single subject issues. And we are trying to provide a relatively straightforward path that 22 other states have used to save lives. That's the idea here, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Myers. Representative Tomaszewski.
Thank you, Chair Gray and the Judiciary Committee for hearing this bill again. I am not going to be so nice. I don't know what's been going on this committee so far today, because I haven't been privy. I've been in my own committee meeting doing a lot of work, and I came in and I hear that this is a complicated issue. This is not a complicated issue. We are talking about the lives of babies here. We are talking about whether a baby is left in a box on the side of the road at 10 below, or whether a baby has an opportunity to live in a box. The longer we debate that issue, the more chances that another firefighter, another emergency technician comes to find a baby unresponsive and pass away. And I find that unacceptable. So please, I appreciate the due diligence, but I also would suggest that we look at the overlying issue and what we can do and give the departments the ability to put these boxes where we can. I thank the committee for doing all that, and I am 2 minutes late to go back to my committee meeting, and I just appreciate the work. And please, let's look at the underlying issue and not get too widespread in our discussions and in what we can do to make everything better. Let's not do the look for the perfect. Let's get what we can do and let's get that done. But
well,
really appreciate it.
I want to do full disclosure to the two sponsors. I really do like the idea of publicizing that a mom who wants to abandon her infant can call 911 and give it to a paramedic. A paramedic can come to wherever she is and take the baby. Maybe some will still use a box. I'm not outlawing the boxes, but I'm saying a safer way is to have her call. She doesn't have to give her name. She can anonymously give that baby up. And that baby, there is, you know, someone taking care of the baby. And then there's a paramedic taking care of the baby. And I apologize if that's really important to me, but it's really important to me to not just do a box, but to have other options that are already legal in Alaska that people don't know about. So
that's the first I've heard of it, just for the record. I haven't heard that from you. I came in hearing this is a very complicated issue. This is not complicated, but I would agree if a mom wants to give her baby to a professional EMT, whatever. Sounds wonderful. Very
Thank
good.
You. They were all in so agreement.
I'm happy that that is the issue. And, you know, I look forward to our bill hearing in 2 days. And then we can get this passed out and get it signed into law.
Thank you. Thank you both for being here.
Thank you,
that
Trigger.
I want to thank all of our invited testimony. Dr. Bruce, Ms. Ozimek, Dr. Zink, we are going to leave the committee substitute on the table and set House Bill 64 aside. That concludes today's business for the meeting. I want to remind everybody that we will not be having committee meeting on Friday, April 3rd or Monday, April 6th. So we will see you again 1 week from today. The time, and thanks again for everybody for staying an hour over. And especially to Sophia Tenney and Jude Augustine sticking with us for an extra hour. The time is now 4:04 p.m. and this hearing of the House Judiciary Committee is adjourned.